Chapter 12. But you must have them, apostrophe replied the passenger, also descending, whether you like it or not. I am your brother. Apostrophe, apostrophe I say. Apostrophe, apostrophe expostulated the driver, becoming more chafed in temper, not to fur. The worm will, when apostrophe, but here, Mr. Crisparkle interposed, remonstrating aside, in a friendly voice. Joe, Joe, Joe. Don't forget yourself. Joe, my good fellow. Apostrophe, apostrophe, and then, when Joe peaceably touched his hat, accosting the passenger with, apostrophe, Mr. Honey Thunder? Apostrophe, apostrophe, that is my name, sir. Apostrophe, my name is Crisparkle. Apostrophe, Reverend Mr. Septimus? Glad to see you, sir. Neville and Helen are inside. Having a little succumbed of late, under the pressure of my public labors, I thought I would take a mouthful of fresh air, and come down with them, and return at night. So you are the Reverend Mr. Septimus, are you? Apostrophe, apostrophe, surveying him on the whole with disappointment, and twisting a double eyeglass by its ribbon, as if he were roasting it, but not otherwise using it. Ha! I expected to see you older, sir. Apostrophe, I hope you will, apostrophe was the good-humored reply. Eh? Apostrophe, apostrophe demanded Mr. Honey Thunder. Only a poor little joke. Not worth repeating. Apostrophe, joke? Eh, I never see a joke, apostrophe Mr. Honey Thunder frowningly retorted. A joke is wasted upon me, sir. Where are they? Helena and Neville, come here. Mr. Crisparkle has come down to meet you. Apostrophe, an unusually handsome lithe young fellow, and an unusually handsome lithe girl, much alike, both very dark, and very rich in color, she of almost the gypsy type, something untamed about them both, a certain air upon them of hunter and huntress, yet withal a certain air of being the objects of the chase, rather than the followers. Slender, supple, quick of eye and limb, half shy, half defiant, fierce of look, an indefinable kind of pause coming and going on their whole expression, both of face and form, which might be equally likened to the pause before a crouch or a bound. The rough mental notes made in the first 5 minutes by Mr. Crisparkle would have read thus, verbatim. He invited Mr. Honey Thunder to dinner, with a troubled mind, for the discomfiture of the dear old China shepherdess lay heavy on it, and gave his arm to Helena Landless. Both she and her brother, as they walked all together through the ancient streets, took great delight in what he pointed out of the cathedral and the monastery ruin, and wondered so his notes ran on much, as if they were beautiful barbaric captives brought from some wild tropical dominion. Mr. Honey Thunder walked in the middle of the road, shouldering the natives out of his way, and loudly developing a scheme he had, for making a raid on all the unemployed persons in the United Kingdom, laying them every one by the heels in jail, and forcing them, on pain of prompt extermination, to become philanthropists. Mrs. Crisparkle had need of her own share of philanthropy, when she beheld this very large, and very loud excrescence on the little party. Always something in the nature of a boil upon the face of society, Mr. Honey Thunder expanded into an inflammatory when in Minor Canon Corner. Though it was not literally true, as was facetiously charged against him by public unbelievers, that he called aloud to his fellow creatures. Curse your souls and bodies, come here and be blessed. Apostrophe, apostrophe, still his philanthropy was of that gunpowderous sort, that the difference between it and animosity was hard to determine. You were to abolish military force, but you were first to bring all commanding officers who had done their duty, to trial by court-martial for that offense, and shoot them. You were to abolish war, but were to make converts, by making war upon them, and charging them with loving war as the apple of their eye. You were to have no capital punishment, but were first to sweep off the face of the earth all legislators, jurists, and judges, who were of the contrary opinion. You were to have Universal conquered, and were to get it, by eliminating all the people who wouldn't, or conscientiously couldn't, be concordant. You were to love your brother as yourself, but after an indefinite interval of maligning him very much, as if you hated him, and calling him all manner of names. Above all things, you were to do nothing in private, or on your own account. You were to go to the offices of the Haven of Philanthropy, and put your name down as a member and a professing philanthropist. Then, you were to pay up your subscription, get your card of membership and your ribbon and medal, and were evermore to live upon a platform, and evermore to say what Mr. Honeythunder said, and what the treasurer said, and what the sub-treasurer said, and what the committee said, and what the subcommittee said, and what the secretary said, and what the vice-secretary said. And this was usually said in the unanimously carried resolution under hand and seal, to the effect that this assembled body of professing philanthropists' views, with indignant scorn and contempt, not unmixed with utter detestation and loathing abhorrence, in short, the baseness of all those who do not belong to it, and pledges itself to make as many obnoxious statements as possible about them, without being at all particular as to facts. The dinner was a most doleful breakdown. The philanthropist arranged the symmetry of the table, sat himself in the way of the waiting, blocked up the thoroughfare, and drove Mr. Tope, who assisted the parlor maid, to the verge of distraction, by passing plates and dishes on, over his own head. Nobody could talk to anybody, because he held forth to everybody at once, as if the company had no individual existence, but were a meeting. He impounded the Reverend Mr. Septimus, as an official personage to be addressed, or kind of human peg to hang his oratorical hat on, and fell into the exasperating habit, common among such orators, of impersonating him as a wicked and weak opponent. Thus, he would ask, "And will you, sir, now stultify yourself by telling me," and so forth, when the innocent man had not opened his lips, nor meant to open them. Or he would say, "Now see, sir, to what a position you are reduced. I will leave you no escape. After exhausting all the resources of fraud and falsehood, during years upon years, after exhibiting a combination of dastardly meanness with ensanguined daring, such as the world has not often witnessed, you have now the hypocrisy to bend the knee before the most degraded of mankind, and to sue, and whine and howl for mercy." Whereat the unfortunate minor canon would look, in part indignant and in part perplexed, while his worthy mother sat bridling, with tears in her eyes, and the remainder of the party lapsed into a sort of gelatinous state, in which there was no flavor or solidity, and very little resistance. But the gush of philanthropy, that burst forth when the departure of Mr. Honeythunder began to impend, must have been highly gratifying to the feelings of that distinguished man. His coffee was produced, by the special activity of Mr. Tope, a full hour before he wanted it. Mr. Crisparkle sat with his watch in his hand for about the same period, lest he should overstay his time. The four young people were unanimous in believing that the cathedral clock struck three quarters, when it actually struck but one. Miss Twinkleton estimated the distance to the omnibus at 5 and 20 minutes walk, when it was really 5. The affectionate kindness of the whole circle hustled him into his greatcoat, and shoved him out into the moonlight, as if he were a fugitive traitor with whom they sympathized, and a troop of horse were at the back door. Mr. Crisparkle and his new charge, who took him to the omnibus, were so fervent in their apprehensions of his catching cold, that they shut him up in it instantly and left him, with still half an hour to spare. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.